Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to be here once again. I think Rabbi Max eloquently explained one of the connections between Hanukkah and marriage. I'd like to look at it from a bit of a different perspective, and maybe through that, focus on some of the issues. The reality is that the threat to the Jewish people in the battles that went on at the time of Hanukkah were not physical. The Greeks, the Hellenists, they didn't want our annihilation physically. They wanted to end our religious observances. They did everything possible to make sure the Jew, with all of his contributions to civilization and to the advancement of modern culture, should stay alive and well. But just on their terms. No Shabbos, and no Yontif, and no Tfilin, and no Bris Milah, and just forget your Jewish stuff, just join together with us. And we know that we celebrate on Hanukkah, that no matter what goes on in history, no matter what we have been exposed to, no matter how sinister the plans of the nations of the world have been to destroy us spiritually, they never did, we're here today, and they never will. And that's the lesson and the inspiration that we're supposed to take from Hanukkah. Now, I'm not a social scientist, but I think it's quite obvious that part of the secret, and the secret is manyfold, and it's also based, it's maybe more based than anything else, on a promise that Hashem promised that lo yishochach mi pizaroi, the Torah and its observance will never be forgotten to the Jewish people. Never, never, ever. It cannot be. But we could look at natural systems and causes and see what naturally contributed to this phenomenon that we continue to observe and partake in the commandments, the observances that have been going on for thousands of years. And I think one of the most significant factors has been the marriage unit, the family unit, the father, the mother, and together, as one, raising their children, raising a family. Now we know that there's a mitzvah on a father to teach his children Torah and to be mechanech them and to educate them in the ways of Torah, in the ways of Judaism. However, there's a very interesting comment from the Rabbeinu Yonah. The Rabbeinu Yonah says on the posuk, "Koy soima lebeis Yaakov v'sagid lebnei Yisrael." Interestingly, when the Torah was given at Har Sinai, it was taught first to the women and then to the men. Kosomar lebeis Yaakov, that's the women. Besagin lebnei Yisrael, that's the men. And many give different explanations why that took place. But the Rabbeinu Yonah writes that ultimately it's the women, it's the mothers that are responsible for the passing on of the Torah to all the future generations. And the men, and everyone in fact, can look askance at that and say, what? The mitzvah to teach Torah is on the father, not on the mother. So how is it that the mother is ultimately responsible for the Torah to be passed on to future generations? And therefore, when it came to Har Sinai, and Hashem was teaching the Torah to the Jewish people, he first taught it to the women, and then to the men. And the answer, he says, is as follows. He says, because the mothers have their children at the most formative stages of life, the earliest years, they spend more time, they're more involved. Maybe it shouldn't be that way, maybe it should be that way, we're not getting into that, but that's usually the way it is. And in those experiences, in those connections, they inspire and mold the midos, the traits of character, the sensitivity, the kindness, the honesty, the integrity, the patience, the ability to control anger and to control jealousy. And all of these traits of character, the mother is the primary source of nurturing these traits. And these traits, midos, character, is the most critical ingredient in the survival of Torah to Klal Yisrael. Because if we didn't have those godly traits, kindness, mercy, truth, patience, forgiveness, and all of the traits for which God himself is known, then the Torah couldn't survive. We're about those traits. We're about character. We're about midos. The Vilna Gaon is quoted, it's not an exact quote, but the Vilna Gaon is quoted as saying, "Im lav tikun hamidos, loma li chayim." If not for improving my traits of character, what purpose do I have to live in the world? And that is the critical role of a mother in the earliest stages, the most formative stages, when the baby is the earliest stages, the earliest years of life. And therefore, the Torah is really in her hands. And the input that she makes on these children, on the next generation, is what assures the survival of the Torah to future generations. So, we're all in this together. Each of us has our own role. But it's only together that we create the proper environment for healthy growth, emotionally, psychologically, physically, and spiritually. And it's that unit, when it works together, when it works in harmony, that can nurture children who are capable of carrying on the glorious banner, the glorious torch of our religion, of our Torah, for thousands of years, have done so, and hopefully will continue to do so into the future until the coming of Mashiach and beyond. So, marriage is very important institution. Today, in some circles, and some lawmakers would have us believe that it's not really important at all. They might even have us believe that we don't even know what it is. And they're going to come up with all kinds of different definitions and ideas. Some of these ideas are very bizarre, but that's not related to us. We know what a family is, and we want to strengthen that unit in every possible way. You know, we know that the Rambam says such a language, says that a man is supposed to be treated like a king. A man is a king. Don't run away yet. But everybody knows that if the man wishes to be treated like a king, he has to treat his wife like a queen. If not, it's not going to work. And that's really what it is. It's a king and queen. A chosen and kala, when they're under the chuppah, as soon as they're united in marriage, they have a halocha of a king and a queen, a melech and a malka. That's what they are. Some say that continues for the whole wedding. Some say it continues for the whole sheva brachos. Some say it continues for 30 days. Some say it continues for a year. But really, it should continue for a lifetime. And if we have that type of a connection, life is different. We share life together. We're one strong unit that can face all the vicissitudes, all the difficulties, all the complications, all the challenges of life, because we're together and each one brings their own contribution to that marriage. And I'm not talking about their monetary contributions. But, you know, there's a certain strength that a man has. There's a certain emotional strength that a woman has. There's a certain, what Chazal call, a bina yesera. She has a certain intuition that the man doesn't have. She has wisdom that he doesn't have. He has ideas and wisdom that she doesn't. Together they complement each other. Now, I could take that. No, it's okay. Together they complement each other. As one unit, they work amazingly well. But it's not only to their benefit. It's not only do they have to whom, with whom to share. They share the good. They share the difficulties. They cry together. They laugh together. They rejoice together. And sometimes they have to mourn together. But they raise and they nurture such a beautiful family. Because there's stability. There's connection. There's love. They model love. They teach love. They live love. They live giving. In fact, the word love, ahava, The shoresh, the root of that word, is to give. Hav. Love is about giving. Unfortunately, many people think love is about taking. No, it's all about giving. When we give, we love more. And when we give each other, we create such a loving bond that can nurture a family and nurture children and inspire them and give them inspiration and stability and desire for living and accomplishing and growing and building families for themselves. So it's really an amazing institution. And I believe that it's this institution that has contributed immeasurably into our survival as a people, because we were able to inspire, to teach, to imbue, to refine the character, to mold, to guide, and to uplift our children, the next generation, and that they should carry on and carry that beautiful torch, that beautiful banner from generation to generation. What can we do? How can we strengthen this unit? How can we bring ourselves even more and more together to nurture even a healthier, a stabler, a more inspired and uplifted and motivated generation? Comes to mind, you know, something which it's hard to achieve, but it's an interesting perspective. There was a great rabbi in Yerushalayim. His name was Rabbi Aryeh Levine. He was known as the prisoner's rabbi. When they were fighting for the establishment of the state of Israel, so many of these groups, there were like different splinter groups. They had their own armies and their own, you know, they were fighting the British, and the British used to take them prison and take them captive and put them in a prison. I think it's the police station today when you go into the old city. And Rabbi Aryeh Levine was known. He used to visit them every Shabbos. He would make a minyan for them, and he would then go and deliver messages to their families. It was an amazing human being. Anyway, the story goes that he once took his wife to a doctor, Dr. Cook. He was a famous doctor in Yerushalayim at the time. And he walks into Dr. Cook and he says, "Dr. Cook, my wife's foot hurts us today." Now, many people make a mistake and they say over that story, "Our foot hurts us." No, sir, it's not your foot, it's her foot. And don't make that mistake. My foot is my foot, your foot is your foot. But my wife's foot hurts us today. We feel each other's pain. The connection is such that pain is that you're in pain, I'm in pain just because you're in pain. And it's a different level of love. It's a different level of connection. It's a different level of inspiration to our children. You know that our rabbis tell us, although it's forbidden to lie, there is one time when a person is allowed to lie, and that's for Sholem Bayis, that it shouldn't cause strife or friction between a husband and wife. Very, very important. That even though that we're so forbidden, it's a terrible thing to say a lie, but you have to keep that relationship positive. You have to keep that relationship on track. You have to keep that relationship loving. And if we don't, if we say something that could cause some friction there, we're doing one of the most terrible things that we can possibly do. You know, our Torah has many systems to keep our marriages intact. One that may not be so obvious, it's obviously important, but may not be so obvious with a marriage, and that is Shabbos. You know what Shabbos does for a marriage? Especially today, when everybody is so busy, everybody has cell phones, smartphones, constantly in contact with the outside world. I'm not talking about the bad contacts which can destroy a marriage. I'm talking about the good contacts, whether it's business, whether it's friends, even whether it's children. And sometimes the concentration is so
so thin that we don't even pay attention. You know, how many times can let's take one, it's going to take the wife or the husband, spouse A or spouse B. Nobody should be offended. Let's say spouse A is sharing some very painful moment that took place today. And spouse B doesn't even hear. Because the phone is ringing. And the kids say the same thing. Shabbos? There's no such thing. It's out of my world. It doesn't exist. There's no phone. There's no communication. There's nothing. And you know what happens? When it's out of sight, it's out of mind. I stop worrying because there's nothing I can do about it. And I pay attention to my spouse and to my children. We sit around the Shabbos table. People, the non-Jewish world is amazed when they come and see a Shabbos sitting around a table and actually talking to each other. That's unheard of. Where do you find families that talk to each other? Oh yes, we're going to have dinner together. You know how many violations there are of dinner together? Oh yes, we always eat dinner together, except Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. We have other important things, and then here I'm out of town, I'm over here, I'm over there. No. Together. Talking. Paying attention to each other. To the children. Everybody's participating. Singing together as a family. Such a beautiful thing. Imagine that. A family gets together once a week and we sing together. It's unheard of. It's unheard of. And it creates such a beautiful atmosphere. And so we have so many. A yontif. A chag. Wow. Not to talk about the material parts of it that we have, you know. Those parts maybe we're better off without sometimes. But anyway, this is the family. We rejoice as a family. We live together as a family. We enjoy as a family. We nurture our children as a family. We make decisions as a family. We show respect for each other, which creates a healthy and wholesome family. I believe I must have said, I spoke here once before, I don't think I ever leave a podium without mentioning this, but if I didn't, I'll mention it now. And if I did, you'll forgive me for the review. Everybody wants to be happy. What's the definition of happiness? Definition of happiness in the Loshon HaKodesh, the holy language, the language of Hashem, that language, every three-letter root has a meaning, and it places that meaning in the world, in the word. Osher, Aleph Shin Resh, is a very high form of happiness. Ashrei Yoshvei Beisecha, very high form of happiness. The Shorish is Ishur, validation. Happiness is feeling good about myself. If there's respect, the person feels good about themselves. When I show respect to my spouse, my wife, to the husband, to the wife, I'm making them feel good about themselves. Why do I respect you? Because you're a quality person. Because you have good ideas. Because you're very sincere. Because you're very good caring. Because you're a very good mother. Because you're a very good father. Because you're a very kind person. Because you put out a beautiful spread, whatever it may be. And respect makes me feel good about myself. And you make me feel happy. Let me share with you, as the oldest person in the room, a secret about life. If you make someone happy, you become the most important person in the world to that person. Because you make me happy. Happiness is what everybody wants. How do you make me happy? Respect makes me happy. Why do you respect me? You ask my opinion. You take my opinion into consideration. You respect my feelings. You respect my time. You respect my space. I think I used these same words. I was talking about children the other time I was here. But it's all the same thing. We're all a bunch of children, and we all need the same things. And you respect me to such an extent. Wow. You made me happy. Used to be a song like that, I remember from my youth. You make me happy. I don't know what. I have no idea how to sing it. But anyway, so this is marriage can be that. Marriage should be that. Marriage must be that. You know, on a very personal and intimate level,
The Torah also has special secrets about how to preserve the tenderness, the excitement in a marriage. One of the things that I found most amazing was that I participated for many years in these outreach seminars to Jews that weren't religious. Arachim was the name of the organization that promoted these seminars. And there were some amazingly powerful lectures. I mean, so powerful that it was like unbelievable. Yet the most powerful lecture that inspired people to want to be religious more than anything else was a lecture on Taras HaMishpocha, family purity, and basically the separation a certain part of the month between the husband and wife. I couldn't figure out why does that attract them? I would have said that says it ain't for me. You know, I'm going to some other religion. This is no interest in that. And yet I realized that talks to a unique situation in life. It keeps life fresh. It keeps things rejuvenated. Our rabbis tell us that after that separation, when they come back together again, they can experience the moment, the exciting moment, as the kala b'chuposa, as the chosan and kala under the chuppah, because they can rejuvenate it. Because the distance, how do they say, absence makes the heart grow fonder. Or let's say abstinence makes the heart grow fonder. Like, we'll change the phrase a little bit. And this is so critical. And when that unit, and when their children see that stability, they act that way too. You know, I've over the years probably counseled, I have no idea the number, but it's probably beyond anything I could even imagine. And so often I hear the refrain, I'm not going to be the way my parents were. You know, they say it with anger. Their parents did this, they did this wrong, and they did that wrong, and they did the other thing wrong. And I'm going to treat my children differently. I'm going to treat my husband differently. I'm going to treat my wife differently. And some of them come back a few years later and say, I'm just we used to say, the spitting image of my father. Exactly the way my parents did it. What's that all about? I had the best example of how not to conduct my life. But you know the lesson that I got? That's the way you conduct your life. That's what we see. You know, they tell the story about a fellow, his father was a shikr, used to drink beyond. And he was always trying to wean his father off the bottle, but he never was successful. One day they're walking along in the street, and he sees somebody lying in the street, sees a bottle of booze next to him, wallowing in the schmutz, and he says, now I have the opportunity of a lifetime. I'm going to cure my father from his problem. And I said, Dad, look what happens when you get drunk. And he walks over to the guy and looks down and whispers, where'd you get those great booze? Wow, look what that does for you. What? The guy is miserable. But when we see, he did it. Somebody did it. People drink. Oh, makes it easier for me. So even though intellectually, when I see inappropriate behavior, I rebel against it. I don't want it. I despise it. It appalls me. But Lamaisa, I see it. And that leaves a greater impression on me than the lesson that I learned. It used to be in the movies years ago, because the movies for me was years ago. But anyway, so it used to be they'd show you crime after crime after crime. And the last 2 minutes, crime doesn't pay. The criminal gets caught. In the meantime, I learned how to commit every single crime in the book. And I saw the glory of it, and the glee, and the excitement, and the happiness, and the fulfillment. And now, hey, guys, crime doesn't pay. The lesson goes out the window, and I learned. What we see is what we do. So we have to be so careful for the sake of our children, for the sake of our grandchildren, for the sake of our great-grandchildren. And the truth of the matter is, our ancestors did this for us. They did this for us. They conducted, their marriages were so wholesome. They were so private. They didn't share them with anyone else. It was private intimacy. It was me and you to the exclusion of the whole world. And that created a whole different system of stability, of love, and of ability to inspire and nurture the next generation to do the same. It's not so easy in the world we live. You know, it used to be that we live a normal life, and every once in a while, we hear something disturbing, and it might shake us up a little bit. And if it's maybe an exciting story or book or movie or something, it might even give us ideas of excitement that may not be so appropriate. But it was once in a while. Today we're bombarded. We're bombarded day and night, whether we turn the technology on or off, constantly with foreign ideas, with sick ideas, with ideas about murdering children, with ideas about destroying the ability of the family to propagate and to lead to future generations. Ideas of children making decisions on whether they're going to be a mother or a father. I don't think that really works that way, but yes, children. They're not old enough to vote. They're not old enough to smoke. They're not old enough to go into a bar and to buy a beer. But they're old enough to decide, I don't want to be a girl anymore. I want to be a boy. Shug in a Welt. I don't know if you speak Yiddish. I heard something, it was a song on Yiddish before there on the thing. Shug in a Welt. You know what that means. The world's nuts. That's the world that we live in. And we're all affected by this. It penetrates, it infiltrates, it can't help but to affect us. And therefore, we have to be so strong. We have to be so strong to reaffirm our values, our commitments, our love, our respect, our responsibility for the future generations. And we have to be vigilant to make sure that nothing allows us, not in mind and not in heart and not in any way, to veer from those goals and from working to make this relationship work. I once had an encounter. I remember sitting in a car in Flatbush with a young man who was having some problems at home. And I explained to him that marriage, like any relationship, you have to work on. You have to work on. A relationship that's not nurtured, that's not constantly updated, that we don't put effort into maintaining and improving, will not last. And he said to me, any marriage that I have to work on, I'm not interested in. We're 12, 15 years later, and he's still not married. I mean, he's divorced and still never remarried. It takes work. It takes effort. But we have to put the time and effort in. And we know what our goal is. Our goal is to live in peace. Our goal is to live as one. It's very interesting that when the rabbis tell us that a person is not permitted to marry a woman unless he sees her first, maybe he'll find something that's not pleasant to his eyes, and he will look down on her. And the Torah says, "V'ahavta l'rechu kamocha," love your fellow Jew as yourself. And many people wonder, that's all? That's all the marriage is? Just love as you love. Oy, what the Torah expects, to love a fellow Jew as yourself. What that, those expectations of not hurting a person in the slightest. Included in that, v'ahavta l'rechu kamocha, is if somebody knows, the Gemara says, if somebody was hanged in someone's family, I shouldn't say, could you please hang up my coat?
The word hang subconsciously hurts. I can't do that. What? Nothing but sensitivity. A person says good morning and or good evening, and we don't respond. Our rabbis tell us it's akin to stealing, because you owe me a response. I said hello. Why don't you respond to me? I mean, the definition of the Torah's concepts of ahavta l'reicha kamocha, loving a fellow Jew as yourself, are endless. And that's the atmosphere and environment that we have to nurture in a marriage. And when we do so, life can be so meaningful and fulfilling. About 6 years ago, a little bit more, I lost my wife. We were married for 48 years. And I tell you, as much as I appreciated marriage when it lasted, I realize now how difficult it is when it's over. It's so painful. Children, grandchildren, Baruch Hashem, great-grandchildren, but we need that. We need that. And we have to keep it close and intimate and loving and respectful and kind and sharing. And we have to hope someday to reach the level of Rabbi Aryeh Levine, where we walk into a doctor's office and tell the doctor, my wife's foot hurts us today. Hashem should help that we should be able to nurture the love and the respect in our marriages and set that example for our children. That we should be able, just as the previous generations were able, to pass on the Torah and Judaism and the glory of Jewish living to our generation, that we should, through this beautiful connection and family unit, to be able to continue passing on our glorious heritage until the day when we will all be able to greet the Mashiach, Mashiach Tzidkenu b'mheira b'yomeinu. I would imagine that some people might disagree with some of the things that were said. I canceled my other appointment for this evening, so I have time. No guts? What? Really? Wow. Either I'm such a good speaker or you're such good guys and ladies. What's that? Okay, let's say it a little bit differently. Any questions? I didn't realize they had such a timid group over here. They weren't so timid last time.
Rabbi, if,
yes, sir.
If I have a way of teaching my kids and my wife disagrees with me, or vice versa, my wife has a way of teaching my kids and I disagree with her, should we... How should we deal with
that? Yeah, I'll tell you, I didn't really cancel my appointment and I have to leave. Oh, yeah. So you touch on maybe one of the most difficult issues in parenting. And there's no simple solution. But I think the knowledge that we have to present a yarachas, one common vision, one approach to our children, has to motivate us to attempt to come to some agreement. Now, in small things, it really doesn't matter. In fact, maybe in small things, it's a good thing that, you know, you have your way, you have your way, either way is okay. But when it comes to something that's really important to us, when it comes to something that's critical to our lives, to their lives, to the future, whatever it may be, then we have to work. Now, sometimes we have to get advice from an outside person, whether it's a professional, whether it's a rabbi, or whether it's a parent, or a grandparent, or a friend, or but we have to try at least to make every effort possible that we are at least
minimizing the differences as much as possible. If we can't do that, then we at least have to agree not to have a tug of war. In other words, even though we disagree, but we're going to keep the expression of our agreements to a minimum. A little bit will come out, but because if we pull the kids in different directions, two things happen. Number one, they will be confused. Number two, and this we better watch out for, they will use us to get whatever they want. They'll pit one against the other, and they will be running your whole family. And they know how to do it, and anybody here who has children over the age of two probably knows exactly what I mean. So therefore, there's no simple solution, but you have to do everything possible to minimize it. It starts with the realization that it's not fair to our children to pull them in different directions. It's more fair that the one with the inferior approach be allowed to influence that approach than the confusion. Of course, if it's in something that's really, something that you cannot allow such a thing, something that has to do with danger, something that has to do with basic, the highest, the strongest of religious principles, then you have to get outside help to try to that's the best I could do, and it's not great. Yes, sir.
There are a lot of young people that I recommend a way of connecting in learning something for the young couple, for the growing family.
Okay.
In learning something together as a husband and wife. Any kind of topic in learning together.
Oh, you're asking me for it? I thought you did a recommendation. Okay. Yes. So I think, first of all, I think that one thing that's so important, and I mentioned it before, and that's anything that has to do with midos. There are a lot of books that are written that talk about just character development. If we were to realize that the purpose of all of the commandments, as the rabbis tell us, it's a Medrash Rabbah in Parshas Lech Lecha, is just to refine human character. That's what it's all about. All of the commandments in a general way and in a specific way, each one specifically and in the general, refining human character. If we could realize that, we would be in a different place because we're constantly working to make ourselves better people. If a husband and wife study things like that, let's say about kindness, there are books about chesed. We study together, we're on the same page with that. There are books about sensitivity, about feeling, about mercy, about patience, about anger control, about things like that. Or there's very famous books today about Lashon Hara, right? Not speaking bad about someone else. That's so big, that's huge. To avoid speaking bad about anybody, it creates a deep-rooted sensitivity to the feelings of other people. When we study these things together, it can be very, very helpful. And once we connect on those things, we're also connecting more with Hashem. So together we've connected with each other, and we've also created a greater connection to Hashem. Because when we are acting in those traits that Hashem is known for, we feel closer to Him. So we've drawn ourselves closer, we've perfected ourselves more, and we've connected more to Hashem, and we'll treat our children so much differently. And they don't want to do that. And it's a whole, it'll continue on generation after generation. Come on. Somebody disagree. What did I say wrong?
I have a question.
Oh, okay.
I guess for the younger couples, for raising children in terms of from a young age, what's the smart way or technique or way, the smartest way, I guess, to actually give the children the proper chinuch amidot and avat Hashem, what would be the most ideal?
Okay. So, the different things that you want to educate them on are very important, and you have to decide which areas are important. You can't overwhelm them with too much. You maybe even prioritize this, traverse this, should be the next one. But one thing I think, the vehicle to have influence on them is love and respect. Because then you're making them feel good about themselves, you're making them happy, and you become very influential. Now, I pointed out, I'm sure last time when I spoke, I think, that parental love is not as validating as parental respect. Because my mother loves me, like my grandmother loves me. It's in the genes. You know, it doesn't mean I'm such a great person. But respect? Why should a parent respect a child? The Torah says respect your parents. Why respect a child? I respect you because you're smart, because you're good, because you're kind, because you're thoughtful, because you're capable, because you're talented, because you're sensitive, because you're... I feel good about myself.
So it's like seeing the positive of the child.
What's that?
It's seeing the positive.
Seeing the positive and communicating it to them. Now, by the way, what you feel inside does communicate. But when you communicate it, it's even more communicated. And be careful about that, too. I've heard parents tell me, oh, I love my kid, I just don't like him. You know? Well, you know something? Even if you only say it to me and you never say it to the kid gets the message. It comes through. And by the way, the spouse gets the message too. We have to look to see the good in people. We have to focus on the good in people. Everybody has good. Everybody has abundant good inside. Covered sometimes with all kinds of strange things. But look beyond. And then work to improve the outside coating, which may not be so beautiful. And it's a formula for happiness. It's a formula for life. It's a formula for success. It's a formula for building a beautiful family. Okay, so I didn't hear one. Yeah, oh, go ahead.
This is actually for older married couples.
Older, younger, it's all the same.
A lot of people, as they get older, and once they retire, they, instead of becoming closer, the marriages have more problems. Well, you know, there's a lot of advice given to young married couples, but I've never seen advice for older. I'm talking about people in their 60s that once they retire, they find that they have so many problems together.
Well, usually when they find that they have problems together, they had problems before,
right,
that they were, they neglected, they were too busy, they each one had their own life, they didn't spend so much time together. So usually, but I think that the key in everything is to look at the good. If a person looks, look how much good. Here we were together for 40 years. Look what you did for me. Look what I did for you. Look, and when you start to focus, you know, we're very quick to forget good. We're very slow to forget bad. Hurt my feelings once, I'll remember it forever. Do 1,000 good things for me, and I forget it. In fact, that same famous Rav Aryeh Levine that I mentioned before, if someone treated him inappropriately, he would say, what great good did I do to that person that he has to treat me inappropriately? That's what we do, because if I do good for someone, they should owe me, and they don't want to be beholden. They don't want to owe. So what do? They tend to deny it. Oh, no, you didn't do any good for me. And they'll do just the opposite. So it's this type of thing. Let's focus on the good. Let's see. And sometimes, you know, they have to also communicate. Sometimes they forgot how to talk to each other. You know, just to talk. And, you know, even in marriage, you can't be accusatory. Oh, why did you do? You're terrible. But we have a right to talk about problems. You know, why are we not feeling the same way? What can we do to rejuvenate it? And there are many things that they can do. You know, there are things that they could do together. Even studying together. There are leisure things they can do together. They go on a trip together. There are ways to build or to rebuild, or maybe for some cases to start building, but it can be done. But you have to work on it, like anything else, have to work on it. And sometimes they need outside advice, you know, from people who've been there. So, yes, sir.
The Rav said that man's purpose in creation is midot, and character development. And the woman was given to the man as a kenegdo to kind of fulfill that goal in life.
Okay.
So that is my wife's role for me. Where is my role for my wife? Or is there one?
No, for sure. Don't think you're getting off so easy. No. You see, first of all, That a woman, what I mentioned, is a woman has a special role in terms of the children in that. In terms of each other, they both share that role. Part of what we do as a couple is we look out for the other one's spiritual growth. You know, the Rambam writes something very strange. He talks about uknei lecho chover, and you should get yourself a friend, and a husband and a wife, that should certainly be a friendship, you know, on steroids. It should be a super friendship. And he lists there from Aristotle three types of friendship. The third level he calls avas hamalo, love of a goal. They want to improve themselves. And he says that they work together to improve themselves, but each one is equally concerned about the other one's development as they are about their own. And that creates such a bond, because we want to get there together. I'm concerned that I get there. I'm concerned that you get there. Now, in marriage, you have to be careful about that, though. Because if you become too concerned with your spouse's development, say, what do you want from my life? Why are you always picking on me? Why are you always criticizing me? Why are you always saying, yeah, be careful. But it's a pursuit together. Not the concern as in terms of criticism, but the concerns of, let's achieve this goal. What can we do together? I love it, you know. We sometimes we have to solicit funds from people. And usually when you go on a fundraising mission, you want to get the check ASAP. In fact, one of the chochmas in old-time fundraising, today it's different because they all send it from foundations, they can't give it to you. But one of the chochmas used to be, get the check now, because he's much more embarrassed to write a small check now than he is when you're not around. So if you let him get away with writing the check tomorrow, he'll send a tenth of what he would have sent. But I love when the guy says to me, I would love to support you, but I have to first consult with my wife. And sometimes then the check is bigger. Sometimes it's smaller, either way. But I have to consult with my wife. We should do things together. It's one bank account. We're in that. I don't mean just the physical bank account, but we're in this together. It's one unit. In fact, I maintain that the whole movement of women's lib and all the feminism that came from it all started because there was no shalom bias, because they didn't feel as one. If we feel as one, then my wife's foot hurts us. We're one. We're all one. Everything's together. Everything is shared. If I do something, you get the credit for it. If you do something, I get the credit. And let's face it, that when we do things and the spouse is home, or when we're out and the spouse is tolerating our absence, we all get the credit. We're in this together. If we weren't there together, we couldn't do it. Raise the children, very, very difficult. Very difficult if there isn't a family unit. So we're in together. I must tell you, I had once an incident. I had a speaker at a Shabbos once in Milwaukee, and I stayed by a family, and the woman was very distraught. Her husband was a brilliant lawyer, a Baal Tshuva, and he never really studied Gemara, never studied Talmud. And she felt very bad, because he was such an intelligent man, and he was missing this brilliant piece of Jewish heritage. So we set something up that he would be able to have a class once a week and a chavrusa two nights a week. And I spoke to her a few months later, and in her voice, I heard as if she was attending those three evenings of learning. She was so overjoyed at her husband's learning, as if she was doing it herself, because there was one bank account. I don't mean, again, the bank. I mean one unit. Everything, we're in this together. And I think that's the way it has to be. Whatever it is, each one is there to help, to complement, to supplement the other. Many, many times, one spouse or another could make a fatal mistake. And I don't mean life and death, but a terrible mistake. And the other one, who's not as directly involved in the situation, says, hey, you know, you're not seeing the full picture. You're a little bit blinded because of this, that, and the other thing. And when we work together, we can turn the world upside down.
Have you said we're supposed to give in yes. marriage? But at the end of the day, we're selfish people. We have things that we expect that we need. So how are we supposed to deal with our needs and our expectations?
Good question. So I would say like this. Number one, The Talmud tells us that a person is supposed to love his spouse, her spouse, as much as they love themselves. Not more. More was in Hollywood. And you know what happens in Hollywood. They're on the 19th marriages over there. Anyway, why? Because we can't love anyone more than we love ourselves. The only one is children, maybe, because they're part of me. You know, so we can love. But otherwise, can't love it as well. But respect, even more. Even more respect. Because respect is something that it's not like I'm showing respect. I'm appreciating. And I think that's part of what we have to really do. In order to be able to give, it's the giving, it's the respecting, it's the thinking, it's the paying attention to all the details and sharing. So we're not looking to love more than we love ourselves. But we have to realize. And then the other thing is something else. Everybody is practical. Whether we admit it or not, we make calculations. And we say, I'm giving to get. That's life. You know, we don't like to admit it, but we're giving with expectations of getting. In a marriage, if a person would stop to think that if I want to get, I have to give. And if I give, I will get. Then it motivates me that, hey, I have to. And when I give, giving is not only an expression of love, but as we said, giving engenders love. So giving, you give, you know, there's some little tender things that people can do. You leave a little note. Thank you very much for, you know. Spouses are sometimes touched. The other one, they brought them breakfast in bed. I don't know what they do. A little gift, a little card, a little things like this can make such a difference. Make such a difference. There are some people that forget important events, like a birthday, or like an anniversary. You know, that's serious stuff. You know, there was a great rabbi. It was well known that he was a rabbi, Josh Silbermans. He was a tremendous, a master machanech. He used to send his friends anniversary cards a week or 10 days before the anniversary so they should remember to send the card to their wives. And they should remember the anniversary. He would remember their anniversaries so that they shouldn't forget. So these little things, you know, there's so many little things we could do. Sometimes just a little, I made something for you, put on the table. You know, flowers every week doesn't really do it because it gets tried after a while. You know what I mean? Like, got to come up with something new sometimes. The flowers are maybe more for the Shabbos, not so much for the wife. You know, oh, I brought you flowers. Yeah, that's the 49,000th time you did that. You know, thank you very much. They're beautiful. I appreciate it. But it has a minimal effect. But I just saw something. I knew you would like it. I picked it up. I saw it was over here. I know, oh, this I think you would like. Taking it home. You know, you see in a bris sometimes that people take the, at a good bris, they actually put out bags that you can take stuff home with, you know. I take it home to my wife. Those little things make a difference. Or I don't think about it. I forget that I have a wife. Or I forget that I have a husband. There, little things sometimes can make all the difference. And by the way, I'm dealing with a tragic situation now, but let's leave that out with someone. But just little things like saying I love you, but not bye, I love you. That doesn't impress anybody. But really, I love you. You know, a little hug, a little something that expresses. There are people that are thirsting for that and they don't get it. They don't get it. And it goes so far. Not when it's demanded, not when it's asked for, not when it's begged for, when it's least expected. You know, somebody did something very nice. Made some good dinner, did something, whatever it may be. Just a spontaneous little expression of goes so long, goes so far. Can make a whole difference in, you know, when it comes too often, it becomes trite. When it comes at the right time, it could make all the difference.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry, what?
I wanted to ask,
Rabbis first, I guess. Okay.
If there is in today's society where we see that there's a lot of more, the trending issue of Shalom Bayit is a much bigger issue than it used to be in the past, is there something that is more, can you be ma'amid al regel achat, like all of the problems that exist as sort of one quality that really defines itself and sort of encapsulates itself in other forms and takes shapes in other ways? Or is it just a bunch of new things? Or is there something more of a common thread, like there's one thing that really links everything together that one can work on?
Well, I don't think I'm smart enough to come up with one common thread, but I think there are a few major points. I think part of, and forgive me because some people may be a little bit uncomfortable with this, the exclusivity of a marriage relationship has oftentimes become lost today. There is far too much interaction with competing entities, let's call it. I'm not talking in business. We're exposed to far too much. You know, I mean, to put it, to be very blunt, from the man's perspective, the wife gets older. And the girls on the street, or the secretaries in the office, they always remain the same age. Mm-hmm. It's hard to compete. You know, from the woman's perspective, the man too, you know. Young, they see pictures, and they hear this, and stories, and this guy, you know. Getting an old man. Not quite. Not my age. But anyway, but you know, this definitely makes a difference. Marriage has to be, it's exclusive. It's me and you to the exclusion of the whole world. Symbolically, I tell people the bedroom should have a lock on it. Nobody should ever be in your bedroom. We have a private space. This is a private relationship. I'll never forget when I moved to Los Angeles, to the San Fernando Valley, the first affair that we had in the school, I came into a house, and before I knew it, I was in the bedroom putting the coats away. Everybody, here, put the coats in the bedroom. You might do it in your bedroom, you know? Come on. Like we say, a yovan in sukkah. Like, I have no, that means like a Greek Hellenist in the sukkah. There's no shaykhs, one with the other, you know? What kind of, and that's why society was the divorce capital of the world. Los Angeles was at one point, I don't know what it is today, the divorce capital of the world. Still is. Okay. People used to come there. I used to marvel. They come there 6 months later, they ain't divorced. I figured out. They came to get divorced. You know, it was a crazy place. So nobody, and but that's symbolic. Nobody, the intimacy between a husband and wife is not to be shared with anybody. It's not, it's a private business. It's a private relationship. We know that it's appropriate conduct that even when a person, oh, let me tell you, California, listen to this, yeah? I hope you'll get the impact of this story. I'm sitting in a board meeting at this school, before we started our own school, we were together with another school, and a lawyer, not a religious man, gets up and says, Mrs. So-and-so asked me to apologize that she couldn't join, she was on the board, she couldn't join the board meeting tonight, she had to go to the mikveh. The whole room had to know from this non-religious lawyer announcing that she couldn't be at the meeting tonight because she had to go to the mikveh. How do they say in French? It's none of your business. What kind of business is that? It's private. It's intimate. No, we don't share this with anybody. And sometimes it's worse. We have these close working relationships with secretaries, with co-workers, with whatever it may be. No. See, it sounds so archaic. It sounds old-fashioned. It sounds so out of sync with modern society. Well, you know something? It is. And that's why marriages fared so much better. Do you know that 50, 60 years ago, there was no such thing in the Orthodox community as a divorce? In the Jewish community, the divorce rate was less than half of what it was in the general non-Jewish community. Today, we're right up there with the best of them.
What's going on? That's why, you know. Same thing, like, you have to be careful what we watch. Have to be careful what we read. Have to be careful because we want to maintain the preciousness and competition. There is competition. There is competition. You know, and especially a woman has children. And after a couple of children, sometimes she doesn't look exactly, you know, like she looked before. Even though it's all his fault, but forgive me. But, you know, but Lemais, and I, oh, that's not the woman I married. Really? Well, you know something, you're not the man she married either. But that's besides the point. So we have to be, I think that this is maybe one of the most important things. Then the other thing is, this, respect. Respect makes people happy, makes you, the person who's making them happy, makes them want to stay with you forever. Treat him like a king. He will treat you like a queen. Treat her like a queen. She will treat you like a king. And they'll live happily ever after. It used to be in the storybooks until modern society destroyed that. We could do it again. That's the best I could do on that one. Yes, there was someone in the back. Was that you?
Yeah.
Okay, apologize.
My next year is about marriage, but of course, to get to marriage, they're dating. So a lot of us in the crowd are single. And
I hope I didn't turn anybody off to marriage.
The differences and the Shalom Bayit issues that we have in marriage, the root of it and the starting point of things could show up also in the dating. And I want to know how to compare and contrast those and how to handle that process
okay.
as well.
I hear. Very good. Now, as in everything, and I don't think I mentioned it enough and did justice to it, Hashem is involved in every aspect of our lives. Without Him, we wouldn't stand a chance. In fact, Chazal tell us, "Bechol yom v'yom yitzro shel odom misgabralov yilmoli akadosh baruch hu oizro eino yocholoi." Every day, you know, a person has a yitzro tov and a yitzro hora, a desire for bad and a desire for good. That's why we get reward for the good we do, because it was a battle. If we were pre-programmed to do good, there'd be no point in it. It wouldn't mean anything. We have no ownership over. We wouldn't deserve anything for it. So the Chazal tell us, the rabbis tell us that the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, wins all the time, except for Hashem stepping in and helping us. So when we really try to do what's right, then Hashem helps us to overpower the inclinations to do inappropriate things. And certainly when it comes to dating, we've got to mamish walk together with Hashem. Why? Because what are we going to know? How long are you going to go out for? If it's going to be too long, then it's just going to get sour and you won't be able to get married with a confidence. If it's going to be too short, you'll say, I don't know anything about the person. All the references, they all lie. Right? So what do you know? So you have to rely on Hashem to help you. However, there are a few things that we have to know. Number one, I like to talk about dating in four stages, four courses, like a college course. The first course is computer science. Very important to find out on paper. Today you don't have paper anymore. You don't use papers and pens. They're teaching me now how to write. No, I'm teaching people how to write. They're teaching me how to use the computer. You know, they don't know how to write anymore. Anyway, so you want to know on paper, does it make sense? You know, do we have similar desires, backgrounds, goals, character traits, as much similarity as you could find or as much compatibility as you could find, but you really don't know that much. The references are not really that informative. The best trick is to call references that are not on the resume, if you can find that. That's very good. But anyway, that's number one. Course number two is chemistry. Chemistry means you go out and just enjoy the conversation. It's nice, pleasant. We have what to talk about. We can enjoy each other's company. We sit for a few hours and it's fine. Very nice. That happens, you know, once, twice, maybe three times. Then the next course is biology. At some point in the not too distant
process, in other words, in the early stages of the process, there has to be some biology. Biology means I start to feel some attraction. I'm drawn. Could be sometimes very heavy. For a man, it might be heavier than for a woman. But there's something there that I look forward to it. I want to be part of it. I want to sit longer together. I don't want it to end. Sometimes it's actually physical. I feel that draw, you know. So then you've seen that the basic ingredients are there. There's one more course, but it's optional. That course is astronomy. Astronomy means seeing stars. Some people only see stars after they get engaged. Some people only see stars after they get married. Some people only see stars after she hits him over the head with a baseball bat. Or he hits her over the head with a baseball bat. So that's optional, you know. But if you feel these things, I like to say it a different way too. I say the starter apartment has to have three rooms. And you have to test those three rooms. There's the kitchen. We just have casual talk over a cup of coffee, you know, and we can just enjoy very chit-chat. There's the living room where we can have more intense conversation, philosophical, religious, emotional, psychological, intellectual conversations, enjoy each other's company, there's stimulation, we can communicate, we see, we understand each other, so forth. And then there's the bedroom. And the dating process has to show us the rudiments of all of these areas. In other words, it's not going to prove it. And anyone who thinks that you can practice or test or pretend before your marriage is out of their cotton-picking mind. Forgive me, I'm not allowed to say that. That's not nice. Okay, but, you know, because you can't. Because it doesn't come with responsibility. It doesn't come with commitment. And there's all this business of testing it out and trying it out and living together. And this is garbage. Garbage. It just misleads people. It confuses people. It messes their lives up. But you can't see if the rudiments... Yeah, we enjoy each other's company. Yeah, I feel something drawing me to it. And I don't have to feel, you know, that I see stars. Some people do, and some people don't, and some people fake it. And you can tell when they're faking sometimes. You know, so that's basically the way I look for it. And then, because of the fact, and these are what we believe are the signs that this is the right person. We don't have, like Eliezer had when he came to find the wife for Yitzchak, and he says, the one that's going to say, I'll also give you camels to drink, she's the right one. We don't have that today. We can't make signs that God will deliver on our sign. But we have a tradition that when on paper it looks good, when there's some chemistry, when some rudimentary biology develops, then and we feel, hey, I want to marry this person. And that hopefully, with prayers to Hashem, with hope to Hashem, that hopefully will bring us that. More than that, we really can't know. We do have to consider sometimes when there are red flags. In other words, everything seemed good, but he made a few comments which are very disturbing. Or she did something which I can't, you know, I can't imagine that. You know, you have to investigate. Sometimes there are other problems that will come up. You want to see that there's kindness. Kindness is, Eliezer used the sign of kindness, of chesed. Kindness is very important in a marriage relationship. Honesty, integrity is extremely important. And trust, which is based on integrity and loyalty, is extremely important. So you want to see, but you will never know completely. If you're not prepared, and that maybe this is a good message for people who are not married, if you want to know 100%, the only way you can know 100% is not to get married. Then you know 100% that the person is not the right person for you. But otherwise, you don't know. But if we put our trust in Hashem, we use a system that we have, and if the relationship, and by the way, the relationship develops, it grows from one day to the next. I feel we're making progress. The rule is you're allowed a bad date, which means like one date you come back and say, oh, it didn't go. Doesn't mean anything. If it was going before, it can very well go more. She didn't like the color of her dress. She didn't like the way you parted your hair. You're wearing it. You know, you never know what. In a bad mood that day. I remember anything could have been. So with one date, but if you got a series of bad dates, that seems to be a sign that it's not for you. And then we got to pray.
Gotta pray. We need such help from Hashem for these things. It's so difficult. But Be'ez Hashem. And it's good to talk about values on the date so that you have a sense. And also, you know, you have to be smart. You have to read in between the lines. You just listen to the lines. Very often lines are rehearsed. In fact, sometimes you'll find the notes right there. He goes out for a minute. You know, you don't want that. But you read in between the lines. You get a sense of who they are. And then Hashem will help. That's Hashem. There should be many weddings here this year. Okay. Anything else? Yes, sir.
I was told by a couple of people that during Shana Rishana, no one should visit the Chatan Kala's house. Can Rav explain like the reason for that, symbolism for that, and
yes,
are there any exceptions at all?
Yeah, I can explain that. I could modify that a little bit. But yes, he says he was told, and not mistakenly, that during the first year, the Shana Rishana, when they just get married, they should not have guests at their house. They should be, you know, together. Now, the idea is this. What is this whole idea of Shana Rishona? For example, you're not supposed to travel separately. If one has to go out of town on a business trip, it's a lot of, you know, there can be, if she's agreeable, it could be, but it's not the right thing. You should be together all the time. What's the reason? So the Sefer HaChinuch says that we tend to love what we get used to. We get used to each other, that enhances the love. So we want, in that first year, they should sort of solidify and cement the relationship. This love before they're married is really... Anyone who thinks there's love before they're married, just get married. You'll see that it takes on a whole new dimension. So this is not where it's at. So they want to strengthen that. And part of that is not to have any competition or interference. If you start, let's say we just got married, and now we're having friends over for Shabbos all the time. A couple. What's wrong with a couple? You know what's wrong with a couple? There's only one thing wrong with a couple. That I'm a man and she's a woman. That's the only thing. Otherwise, there's nothing wrong. It's very nice to have over couples. But, you know, hey, why is it she speaks so much nicer to her husband than you speak to me? Why is it that he, you know, at the beginning, get used to each other. Solidify the relationship. That doesn't mean there aren't exceptions. That doesn't mean there aren't times when you should have people, when you have to have people. I advise, for example, our bochrim, when they get married, I tell them, I say it's much better to get a one-bedroom apartment than a two-bedroom apartment. Why? Well, it costs a lot less. But because then you don't have a place for guests. What do you mean? You have a guest room. Well, we're coming for Shabbos. That means even parents and in-laws. The first year, a little bit, maybe, but let them develop their relationship together. The more solidified that relationship is at the beginning, and by the way, before children come too, that's very important. The very beginning, they solidify. By the time they have children, they're already, they're confident. They're confident in that relationship. They feel that strength of the bond, and things work much better. So that's, I wouldn't say it's absolute, but it's very good advice. You know, within reason. All advice, by the way. You know, somebody, an old rabbi once told me, there's four sections of Shulchan Aruch. There's Arachayim and Yeridei and Ezra and Chesha Mishpat. He said there's a fifth section. He says, and you have to learn all four with the fifth section. He says the fifth section is called Seichel. You gotta have Seichel too. You know what I mean? Your parents want to come. They want to come. But no, you can't come. I'm sorry. It's the anniversary in 5 months. You have to wait. Especially if they're supporting you. So that's the story. Okay. Yes, sir.
Sometimes in a marriage it could be possible.
A little louder, please.
Well, sometimes in a marriage could be possible one spouse accident might say or do a certain action that the other spouse isn't happy with or bothers them for a certain amount of time. So what would be the best way to communicate that feeling without making the other spouse feel like garbage for doing it?
Okay, so I think there's a pre-stage to communicating that feeling. And that is each spouse has to communicate with the other one that it's human to make mistakes. We all make mistakes. And since we know that we all make mistakes, we're all very quick to forgive. Once you create an atmosphere of recognition that we're all human, then it's not so difficult. But even then, the rule is like this. Never put down the person.
only inform how the action hurt or was painful or was negative or, but you, how could you? No, no, no. I just want to let you know, as much as I appreciate, as much as I love you, as much as I know how you do good, but that particular thing, that hurt me a little bit. I just want you to know for next time, that's all. You know, I forgive you. No, I can even think about it. I just wanted to mention it. And the other one, of course, has to know the two most important words in any language. I'm sorry. In Hebrew, it's better. Only one word, slicha. You know? But that's what they have to know.